your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I enjoyed the movie. As I said, I really do like the movie, but let's not kid ourselves that A, it has anything original in terms of a storyline at all, because it doesn't, and B, it isn't real F1 racing.
This week, we have a stellar lineup of movie industry insiders as we break down this summer's blockbuster F1 movie, which has earned over $500 million at the box office so far. So it really does deserve some deeper consideration than we've given it so far. In part two, we're going to compare it to the 1960s classic Grand Prix, as well as other great motorsport films like Rush, Days of Thunder, and Le Mans. Are they any good as movies? And what does it take to create a movie that appeals to all audiences, not just motorsport enthusiasts? How well do the stories work? What about the all-important action sequences? How does the treatment of female characters compare? And do movies like this actually do any good for the sport? With me, I'm delighted to say I have UK movie industry royalty. Eddie Hamilton, editor of Top Gun Maverick and the two most recent Mission Impossible films. Eddie, welcome.
Hello, James. Thanks for inviting me on.
Great to have you here. Adrian Wootton, OBE, runs the British Film Commission, encouraging productions like F1 to film in the UK, a major film scholar and an F1 fan. Adrian, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Mark Lane is an award-winning movie producer with over 40 credits, including I Am Not a Serial Killer and The Cut. He's also a keen car racer in his own right. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
And Nick Manzi is a producer with a string of hits from Blitz to salmon fishing in the Yemen, and he's also a lifelong F1 fan. Nick, great to have you here.
Hi, James.
So let's start with F1 the movie, Apple's blockbuster that's so far taken over $570 million at the box office, making it Brad Pitt's highest grossing movie in his career. I ask this with some trepidation, considering I'm sitting with four movie industry heavyweights, but is it any good? Did you actually enjoy it, Adrian?
Yes, I did enjoy it. Actually, I was very pleasantly surprised. I enjoyed it as much as I did. I don't know whether I went in with relatively low expectations, but no, I think that, I mean, it's probably, and I'm sure the colleagues around the table will say this, I'm sure none of us probably expected it to be as big a hit as it's proved to be. But I think as a movie, apart from whether you're interested in F1 or not, it's very entertaining. And I saw it actually the first time in a commercial cinema, and it was packed, and it was packed with very, you know, diverse audience who all really loved it as a commercial entertainment.
Yeah, as a film editor and someone who is deeply embedded in film productions for years as they're getting made and knows how hard it is to make any film, let alone a good film, right? The weird chemistry of ingredients that has to come together to make a movie that works for audiences around the world is extremely unique. No one sets out to make a bad film. Let me tell you that. Everyone who starts on a journey of making a film wants to make a great film that will appeal to as many people as possible. And I've worked on all kinds of movies, some of which that have done great. Obviously, Joe Kaczynski was the director of F1, the movie. Jerry Bruckheimer was the producer. And I worked with them both on Top Gun Maverick. So I've already got like a kind of warm association. I've already got a warm association with them as the producer and a director, and a friendship built up over the 2 years I worked on Top Gun Maverick. So I saw it with a packed house of people who were thrilled to be there because it was such a great event. And it played incredibly well. And I did really enjoy it. I thought Stephen Mirioni was the editor. So I'm going to call out the editor for all these movies because I know he had...
The unsung heroes, right?
Unsung heroes, but he had like half a season's worth of every single camera from every Formula One race to review, to build the race sequences, along with hundreds of hours of footage of cameras mounted to cars to tell the story. And I went through a similar experience on Top Gun Maverick, where I had around 800 hours of footage to build a two-hour movie. So the gigantic complexity of boiling down all this raw footage into a story that makes sense, that is emotional, that is engaging with characters that you care about, is a Herculean task. And so as a fellow editor, I can watch it and I have slight PTSD on behalf of the editor, Stephen Mirioni, and what he went through over 2 years about just trying to wrap your head around the puzzle of this film. And the thing about the F1 movie, which we'll get to, is, you know, visual effects were used extensively in the film to augment the images that they captured. And, you know, almost, well, I would say at least half the shots, they changed the tires on the cars, for example, because the wrong tires were used when they were filming. And as the story evolved and the tires changed, they had to make sure that the tires matched for all the F1 fans who'd be keeping an eye on those details and things like that, which you wouldn't think about. Brad Pitt is a gigantic movie star in this film, and he understands how to be a protagonist and a movie star in a film like this. And I thought Damson Idris was great. I thought Hans Zimmer's score, I prefer his score to Rush. I think I prefer his score to Days of Thunder, but Hans Zimmer co-wrote the score with Steve Mazzaro, and I thought it was very effective and unique. You know, I was kind of hoping for The Chain by Fleetwood Mac to pop up somewhere, you know, for us, you know, Formula One fans from the 80s and 90s, of course. But I did really enjoy it. And my wife, who is the toughest critic, went along with my other daughter to see the film another time. And she also really enjoyed it. So I'm so thrilled for everybody involved that the film has reached such a gigantic audience and has done as well as it has. You know, it's great for all movies when movies do well. So I'm always cheering on every film that gets released in a cinema.
Nick?
Oh, I'm speechless now. It was fantastic. I mean, you know, it's hard to tell a story like that and remain authentic, but also keep the drama going. And it did both really, really well. So, yeah, I was expecting the worst and came out very pleasantly surprised.
What about our other producer, Mark? Are you going to give it the thumbs up as well, or did you spot a few things you'd rather change?
No, I'd love to offer a different opinion, to be honest, just for some friction. But no, I went in with the lowest possible expectations, like as a like everyone at the table, it sounds like a lifelong F1 fan. And I'd been put off and hadn't watched any races since a couple of years ago when Lewis lost his title through...
Rot.
Yeah, what I thought was the non-application of the rules. And honestly, I haven't engaged with Drive to Survive probably very bitterly, seeing that as part of the downfall of what I liked about the sport. And I've always said to anyone that would listen, I don't think you can actually crack F1 as a movie. So I went in fully expecting to hate it, and I thought it was amazing for everything that the guys have just said. I mean, it's kind of like the best people doing the best work with the best access, and you know that they've ended up with a great movie.
Adrian, why does motorsport and particularly F1 work as a backdrop for a fictional movie like this? Obviously, we've seen plenty of great documentary work around Formula One in the past, and Mark's just mentioned Drive to Survive there, which is in its own way a kind of fly on the wall sort of behind the scenes thing, but as a fictional backdrop for a Hollywood blockbuster, I mean, when I look at Formula One and certainly my lived experience over the last 35 years, the things I've seen, sometimes fact is stranger than fiction, and there's been a lot more extreme things happen that I've seen than actually happen in this film. But what do you think makes it a suitable backdrop?
I think it's a suitable backdrop, and it has a long history. I mean, there's been, you know, motor racing movies since the silent era. You know, I mean, starts practically with Charlie Chaplin, Kid Auto Races, I think, 1914. And then you have the first, you know, in the early days of the sound era, Howard Hawks and The Crowd Roars, James Cagney and Joan Lonell. So it goes back to the very dawn of movies. And I think it's because of, you know, glamour, death, rivalry, conflict. They're all there, you know, to be picked apart. There's always, you know, men testosterone competing against each other. They're normally arguing over women as well. As a death and death, danger, suspense is never far away. And so it offers the filmmaker a very straightforward series of kind of narrative themes that they can play with, and cast very glamorous people in them, in terms of the stars of the film. So I think that, having said all that, however, and I'm sure we'll come back to this, is that it doesn't work very often. I think that's why, when we've just all gone around talking about what, all of us being surprised about F1, the movie, being good and being so successful, is that there's been a lot of motor racing movies, but actually few of them have been very good about motor racing. They've used the backdrop of motor racing to various degrees of authenticity and effect, but very few of them have you ever come out of them and gone, yeah, that has some kind of approximation of what motor racing's really like, or and what the drivers are really like, and what their lives are really like. It's often, you know, at all. I mean, I'm a great fan of Elvis Presley, and he made three different movie musicals that use motor racing as a backdrop, but no one would call them authentic at all, you know.
The other thing is, what cinema does really well is motion. They're called motion pictures. And of course, the essence of motor racing is motion, is going fast and putting cameras on the front of a car with a wide angle lens 3 inches above the tarmac gives you this incredible ground rush and sense of speed, which you can't create in any other art form, really, and give the audience that intense sense of speed and excitement and danger.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
Just let me ask the two producers here, when you're creating a film, what are the elements that are essential to creating a really good movie? I mean, obviously the story is going to be one of them, and making sure you've got the right actors and this, that, and the other. But when you actually start to put a movie together, what do you know you've fundamentally got to get right?
Well, it's what Eddie was saying. You need a great editor, great director, great cinematographer, because they're going to capture it and they're going to figure out quite how to realise it and convey the energy, the speed, in a way that an audience will connect with. That would seem like the best place to start.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, I think even with all those things, you know, what was interesting was how you were saying, Eddie, about having the camera like 3 inches off the floor and that connection and that, you know, how that communicates speed. It's still even hard though, because so like having been in a car, and I'm sure obviously everyone maybe even been on a track day or something, even that experience is so hard to actually, like, I find to actually get right on the screen.
Yeah.
Because like I race a very lowly Honda Civic, and still I see my out of car footage and I think, God, I look like I'm going like 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And yet somehow what this did so well was all of the shots, I thought, somehow communicated that speed. And we spoke briefly about it borrows shots directly from Grand Prix, which at the time felt so ahead of its time. But
Grand Prix,
everything about it had an innate understanding of racing, even if it didn't seem like it, you know, on the outside.
I think a lot of these films as well, all of them in fact, the central dramatic question, which we've talked about, is why do racing drivers do this, right? What motivates them to be seconds from death for hours at a time? And how do the people in their lives relate to their loved ones who live to race and die sometimes. And all the films ask that question and answer it in a kind of similar way. And I'm a big fan of Rush. You know, we'll talk about that, the James Hunt and Niki Lauda, you know, movie. And I think what that has going for it is the fact that it's a true story, which lends it this incredible authenticity. The fact that Niki Lauda recovered so quickly because he was so angry with James Hunt. And it was that rivalry which drove him to find himself back on the track and to race in that was it 1976, that season. And F1, the movie, does not have that because it is totally fictional. Fictional team, fictional characters. So it lacks that. And I think if for me personally, when we're talking about it, I prefer Rush because it has this true story, and it's actually more about the conflict and the rivalry between these two men. I think with F1, some of the angles that they have when you're so close to Brad Pitt driving and you can see his face literally driving the car, some of the profile shots you can see when the cars are overtaking, they're just extraordinary what they did. But borrow heavily from the visual language of John Frankenheimer's Grand Prix, which we'll talk about. Some of the shots are identical, the way they could pan the cameras on the car. Mm-hmm. They had, in Grand Prix, they were using 65mm film, which is hugely heavy. The cameras are like 100 pounds each or something. So they were having to build rigs on the car to balance the camera platforms. And they were literally using almost iPhones for F1, the movie. The cameras are so small, which allowed them to be aerodynamic and to hide the cameras around the car so you couldn't even really see there were cameras attached necessarily. But I think the fact that Brad Pitt is racing for real and Damson Idris is racing for real, and they're on the real racetrack, you know, embedded with the cars. The one thing I was curious about is how they did the start of some of the races, when you were like, well, they can't have interrupted the start, and the cars were apparently at the back of the grid. Is that what they did? And so they were racing, but then they used visual effects to add extra cars to make it feel like they were further forward in the grid and things like that, which I just thought was mind-blowingly well done, totally seamless. When they went to the FIA and to all the drivers and the teams to explain what they were going to do, they would show them clips of real F1 races where they had inserted the Apex GP team car into actual footage, and it looked totally seamless. And so they were able to prove to the F1 community that the technology was up to the standard which, you know, they were all hoping it would be, which is another reason why the movie feels so real, is because the visual effects artists are so skilled that it doesn't even occur to you. And there are thousands of visual effects shots in the movie, but you just don't have a clue because they're so well done. They're invisible.
I mean, the other thing to say is you need access. And that's the thing that I guess you have on Top Gun and F1 the movie had, and Grand Prix, and even Days of Thunder, is the ability to work with the racing series and be there and shoot and try different stuff and work it out, which I think, you know, if Mark and I were making a film, that's, if we couldn't get that, we couldn't make the film. I mean, you probably could, but it would certainly not feel as authentic and as real as this movie does.
I mean, I'd agree with that. I agree with everything that you both just said. My only two counterbalances are that obviously what Apex does and what Brad Pitt does in the car, he would start the first race and then be banned for the rest of the series. So the whole plot is completely absurd in that sense, because he doesn't actually drive like a real F1 driver for the majority of the film. And secondly, and don't get me wrong, I completely agree with what they said about Brad Pitt. He's fantastic in the film. They're both good, great. Damson Idris is great in the film. But again, the story is about as hackneyed as it's possible to have a hackneyed story about the old guy coming back to essentially, you know, shape and mentor the new upstart, you know, driver. And it's not only lifted from other you know, motor racing movies, it's lifted from about 500 other types of movies as well, whether it be westerns or thrillers. So I enjoyed the movie. As I said, I really do like the movie, but let's not kid ourselves that A, it has anything original in terms of a storyline at all, because it doesn't.
Yeah.
And B, it isn't real F1 racing. What it has is it uses the wrapper of real F1 racing and fantastic footage, but the actual racing between the drivers is fantasy racing that isn't F1 racing, because Brad Pitt actually gets them score points by crashing everybody off the road.
If Joe Kaczynski was here, because I did ask him this question, I will just, if Joe listens to this podcast, which he might, in his defense, I will say that everything that happens in F1 has actually happened in real F1 races, just spread over many decades. They're just compressed into one movie. But Joe made, he was like, the same thing with Top Gun Maverick. Everything that Maverick does in a plane, you can do, but it's just, it's always on the edge, and it's the last thing that you would possibly do in a life or death situation. It's just that we've compressed them all into one movie. So he would say, as a point of fact, that it is all real. You know, things that happen have all happened in different F1 races. It's just they haven't happened in the last six races of a season.
Yeah, I mean,
please fire away.
All of that, I think, is accurate, but I was actually going to say, like, I actually think that in talking about all the technical achievement and how wonderful it is, you can lose, I think, how good an exercise the script actually is. I agree, it's you know, it's entirely hackneyed and silly, but it also, it does do that thing of it treads a fine line, because F1 fans now are not only a new generation, which is great, but very like well informed, and you have things that you didn't have previously to contend with, like the radio messaging. I thought was so good that they didn't ever like telegraph the problems. Like, he was always on the radio saying the right things, like, whoopsie daisy, I've not engaged neutral, never actually giving away the quite obvious absurdity of some of the moves he was doing to keep treading that fine line.
Yeah.
And I think if the movie doesn't win you over, then every time it steps over that line, you go, well, that's absurd. But for me, it was, I'd already heard the character Sonny Hayes' name and kind of like, gone, this is going to be so stupid. No chance. But that opening, like, he walks out of his, you know, camper monster truck onto the pit, and it's so authentic, and everything that happens in that opening Le Mans race is so good. If it was Le Mans, it was GT somewhere. All of that did so well, including Whole Lot of Love. Like, that by the time he walked back out to go back to his camper, I was like, we're in safe hands.
Yeah.
And so I give it, you know, a little bit more room because of that. 100%. These people know what they're doing.
I also think that because Lewis was involved so heavily and consulted every step of the way along the 2, 3, 4 year journey it took. I think it was 2 years of development and then a year of photography and then a year of post-production. You know, everything is authentic. You're listening to the gear shifts. He would like tick them off for not having the correct, it's like, you're in third gear here and you should be in fifth gear, and I can hear the difference and you need to fix that. And so everything is completely authentic because he was there making sure and blessing the movie second by second, you know. And they also had F1 commentators, right? Real guys doing it. And they would, I don't know their names, but Joe would invite them in and they would sit and they would watch and they would ask what the terminology would be. And so when you hear, and the way it's mixed is so good, like it's all in the surround speakers and it's so immersive and cool. And I think literally the cutting edge of sound technology as well. Like, my word, what a job they did on that. And all the movies, actually, the sound teams don't really get that much love because, you know, everyone's talking about Steve McQueen in Le Mans and everyone's talking about John Frankenheimer and you know, James Garner in Grand Prix. But the sound of all these movies is also part of what gives you that thrill. And the sound of F1 is I wouldn't be surprised if it wins the Oscar this year for best sound.
Yeah, well, of course, in Grand Prix, that's what it won the Oscars for, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was sound editing, film editing, sound effects.
Yeah.
Grand Prix.
It's so hard. I can't tell you, it is hundreds of hours of work to do that. Every single shot will have like 50 or 60 layers of sound. And that's every shot in the movie, of which there'll be like 4,000. So the complexity of how much time and care and dedication has been poured into it by so many people who are desperate for it not to suck, and for the F1 world to not go, well, that's ridiculous, he's in third gear and he should be in fifth gear. You know, they really care about that stuff, which is another reason that...
But also, Adrian, I take your point about being... It's a bit hackneyed. But on the other hand, it's what Hollywood movies do so well. Mm. It's understanding that you've got to leave enough space for the shock and awe of it. You've got to have the drama. You've got to have the movie stars. What you were saying, Eddie, about Brad Pitt knows, it's a bit like the Steve McQueen thing. Mm. He knows what he represents. At the end of this movie, he has to win the final race, right? Which is ironic that Damson knocks Lewis Hamilton out of the race. But that's what you need to do in Hollywood cinema to reach everyone.
In Le Mans, Steve McQueen doesn't win, just saying.
That's an interesting point, is that, no, I completely agree. The reason this movie actually, apart from all the technological stuff we talked about, the reason I believe it's a commercial success is because Brad Pitt does his job brilliantly as a movie star.
Yeah,
he's fantastic in it.
Yeah.
And he puts that film on his shoulders and does what a great movie star, like a Tom Cruise, and there aren't very many of them that can carry a movie like that and own the cliches and own the character and make audiences go, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's Brad Pitt and he's terrific, you know, and he's playing alongside this young actor. And, you know, is casting over him that glow, that uber movie star glow. So, no, I think, it's the reason Le Mans, and I am second to none in my love for Steve McQueen, but Le Mans is Steve McQueen's Annus Horribilis. It's Steve McQueen's big mistake.
Yeah.
It's Steve McQueen's hubris.
He wishes it wasn't.
No.
You know, he put so much into it and risked so much to make Le Mans.
But he wouldn't listen to anybody about what made a great movie, you know. So I think that, whereas Brad Pitt knows exactly what his job is and carries it out perfectly in F1, and you can feel the audience, you know, as you said, from the minute, you know, he steps out of that trailer and walks across, you're thinking, this is a real movie star big movie.
The music,
it's like, yeah, I know what I'm doing, and the audience is going to be with me and for the next 2.5 hours, and they are, and that's why the movie, I think that's one of the big reasons the movie works. And it's exactly the same. I think Jerry Bruckheimer actually said it about working with Tom Cruise and working with Brad Pitt. There's a difference between working with real movie stars who really know what their job is and are, you know, and want to work really hard to do it. And you can see it in F1, and I think it's great.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
One area that I didn't like about this film and was disappointed, if I've got to be honest about, is I think that the part of the female technical director, Kerry Condon, is done unbelievably well. She observes it really well. I know some of the women that she based her character on, Bernie Collins, who used to call the race strategies for the Aston Martin Formula One team, and Ruth Buscombe, who was also on the pit wall calling strategies for Sauber and Haas and various other teams as well. These are women who are engineers who are embedded in the heart of the sport, and there are more of them than people perhaps realise, and they certainly helped her. She carries it off, even the way she kind of wears her pass into her shirt and the way her shirt is, and the way she wears her headphones, she just looks like a plausible female technical director. She's smart. It's great. Why does she have to end up in bed with Brad Pitt? It's this 2025, for God's sake. Why does that have to happen?
That goes all the way back to how successful the movie's been when we were talking about it, you know, like, is that a surprise. It wasn't, I didn't think a surprise that it was so successful, because it's going to be catering to a younger audience. And in just what you said there, I noticed a very interesting takeaway as a, you know, middle-aged guy, you know, was we cut away from the sex scene that never happens. Obviously, in Days of Thunder, you know, which is a, you know, huge comparable, they linger on it. And here they kind of like go against the wall, have a little kiss. And then we cut to the Damson Idris partying, and it was all like Heineken 0%, you know, alcohol branding. So I was like, this is really them telling us, like, we're trying to have our cake and eat it here, where we're trying to cater to a young audience and an older audience. And I was surprised, yeah, that, you know, that character was drawn so well. I thought there were moments when she was actually almost acknowledging, like, there's a moment where, you know, Sunny kind of like gives her a look, and she's kind of like, and does the whole like eye roll in spite of herself that she's falling for him almost. So it's kind of like telling us, like, you've, like, we all fall for him. Like I said, by the time he walks off the track in the first racing sequence, you're like, I want to be this guy.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we hope. And you kind of like allow, or I did, you know, again, I'm not probably trying to complicate it, but I was like, I'm going to allow her to fall in love here. Or I don't even think she feels like she's fallen in love. Kind of feels like they just have a little, you know, a little get together, and then they decide to meet down the road. And again, even that was so measured, because he's like, you know, I would have just previously in the 90s, I'd have buggered off, but now he has to cover himself. You know?
Don't forget also, this film would have been tested with audiences. So they would have shown this, and I don't know whether you know this, Eddie, that they would have shown this to multiple audiences to try and calibrate quite whether they needed more of that character, less of that character, whether the audience wanted to see them get together, whether or not. And I suspect they played with it to kind of make sure that as wide an audience as possible won't be too upset by them ending up in bed. But on the other hand, there needed to be some sort of romance. And I would imagine that's probably the process.
I agree. I you know, we can talk about another actress, Simone Ashley, who was cut out of the film, apart from one shot, I think, at the beginning of the movie in a montage. She was Damson Idris's love interest, this stunning, fantastic actress, Simone Ashley, who was in season 2 of Bridgerton. And when I met Stephen Mirioni at the premiere and I said, what happened to Simone? He said, well, the test audiences felt like the relationship between Damson Idris and his mum was a more interesting dynamic than it is with the female love interest, a younger lady, you know, girlfriend. And they just didn't, they found it like clutter in the story and they didn't need it. And so unfortunately they removed her. They left her in the film so she could get her, you know, SAG residuals. But I actually think the movie would have worked as well if the relationship had been professional admiration and respect and not consummated. You know, we have in Mission Impossible, Tom Cruise, we have a character called Ilsa Faust, who was in Rogue Nation and Fallout, and she's a British spy who and we experimented with having them kiss in the film, and the audience preferred that it was just professional and that they hug, and there's just this unspoken respect which could be consummated in a different world where they weren't doing the jobs that they were doing. And I feel it would have actually been just as effective. I probably would have preferred that, actually, if there'd just been chemistry there, which was not consummated.
Well, and it's interesting, just interjecting on that, because the way I tend to think about that relationship, and I agree with you, I agree with James, I don't really think it needed to be, inverted commas, consummated, because actually what it seemed to be playing off was Hawks and His Girl Friday. It's that kind of relationship. It's absolutely, you know, with, you know, the Cary Grant character, who is boss and ex-partner of, you know, the journalist Rosalind Russell. And it's the same dynamic. It's absolutely that dynamic. And of course, in that movie, they had, in that classic screwball comedy, they were previously romantic partners, now they're just kind of fighting each other all the time over the job they're supposed to be doing.
It's delicious.
And it's wonderful.
It's so good.
It's brilliant. And it seems like they had that there, but then in F1, they wanted to push it into that, again, more cliched perspective. And actually, I don't think they need to do either. I think they could have made it even funnier.
But Adrian, that's why I think it is possibly a product testing.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It's the Lost in Translation thing where they never get together and it's actually funnier.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether when you look at how successful this movie's been around the world, there would have been territories where, but certainly in America, where perhaps they would have wanted them to consummate. I don't know, but it sort of feels like they probably had a lot of elements to play with.
You're right.
The Damson's partner. And actually, interestingly enough, I suspect also the thought process would be, well, if we take out Damson's love interests, so that's about the mother and the son, we do need a romantic interest, and it's got to be Brad Pitt and the...
Kerry Condon.
Let me just change gears slightly, if I may, because we've talked about the success of this film. Let's put it into... Can you actually break it down for us? Because you understand how this industry works. So I think the general feeling is that the budget for this film, I'm told it was astronomical, but it seems to have been somewhere between $200 or $300 million. I mean, one of the most expensive films ever made.
Not really.
That's a kind of average. That's an average budget for a big budget movie.
The other thing you have to remember is any movie that was shot in like the last 3 years had to deal with COVID and a strike. Both of those things cost money, a huge amount of money. And certainly for Mission Impossible, the films I worked on, it was a gigantic drag on the budget of the movie.
So let's have a guess at what you think the budget might have been.
It probably is 250, 300. I mean, it's hard to say, but I mean, some of the Marvel movies are 500.
No one will ever tell you.
No.
Because no one wants to admit. So there's like somebody at the studio, an accountant will know, and the head of the studio will know, and not many other people.
Well, you can find out, actually, you can find out pretty much because it's in the tax credit. Mm. It's in the tax credit information. And F1, the movie, will have got it. I'm sure it did cost exactly what Nick said, because those movies, it's true of the Top Guns of this world as well, those movies tend to be costing 250 to 300. Marvel movies do. The Harry Potter movies cost in excess of 300.
Top Gun was like 180. It was less because... Two-thirds of the movie is people talking in rooms on the ground, and only one-third of the movie is fighter jets, you know, and the Navy gives them the fighter jets. We just paid for the fuel, which is $20,000 an hour for fuel. But that's all we paid for was the fuel for the jets.
Fantastic.
You know?
And so you've then, on top of that, got marketing costs, which I think you estimate, Nick, to be, what, around about 100 million?
Well, probably the same amount. I mean, it's...
So what do you think that... So it's made 500... Well, I'm trying to get to here is it's made $570 million. How far before it washes its face?
It's taken $575 million. Probably it's got Warner Brothers, who distributed it, I think, globally, probably have got $250 million, maybe a little bit less, of which they're going to take their fees out of it. Probably 10%. They probably spent couple of hundred million dollars releasing it. So weirdly, it hasn't made any money yet.
How far before? What will it have to gross before it does actually make any?
Probably a billion.
Really?
But we've got to remember, this is a very unusual situation because this has been financed by Apple. And Apple don't see it in the same way as the studio does. Apple see this as the promotional benefit to Apple, the brand, and also how much would they have had to pay to buy this film down the line to have it across their platform.
And of course, I guess you could argue that who it's done the most benefit for, apart from Brad Pitt, is Formula One itself.
Yeah,
because it's showcased so much about the sport, and from their point of view, why they encouraged it, allowed the sport to embed it, to allowed the film production crew to embed themselves in the sport, is because it opens it up to a whole new audience.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the budget, but the interesting thing is you really can't quantify the budget anyway because of the access that you spoke about. Like, that's just priceless. Like, it's like you're saying that, you know, with Top Gun, that movie only exists if they go, we'll give you the jets. And it's the same here, that you couldn't have paid for, you know, to have that access. Like, you know, as an independent producer, I watched the opening credits, and when it came up as Apple Presents, I was like, well, all the budgets of all the movies I've made wouldn't have made that opening sequence. Like, I couldn't have, you know, we couldn't have done that. It's only when F1 decides to do it. And like, how good is that for the fans that they have said, let's give access and let's make this thing as kind of a loss leader, because it only happens when Apple comes together with F1 and everyone abandons all reason of money and goes, just give the fans what they want, which is why I think it tries to balance the older generation and the new generation of fans.
Well, yeah, because I was just going to interject and say, because I think Jerry Bruckheimer got quite annoyed when people started bandying $300 million around for the cost of F1, because, and he talked about the sponsorship, and the fact is that all of those normal charges that F1 would have levied on anybody using their brand, their rights, their drivers, anybody, and Mercedes building, you know, the rigs for the essentially the F2 cars cloaked, you know, to look like F1. All of that, I think, came under the level of sponsorship and F1's contribution. So if you added that on in what they would really normally have charged, the budget would have been completely and utterly ludicrous. So it probably was much cheaper, because exactly what Mark's saying, of that access, much cheaper than a straight commercial movie would have been.
So finally, because we have to bring this to a close, fascinating discussion it's been. I can't have you in the room as a person who's edited all these action movies like Top Gun and Mission Impossible without just telling us, when you're looking at the movie mix, how often Do you plot out how often you need to have an action sequence? And is there any kind of science about how long they last and the frequency of them for modern audiences? So what's the thinking that goes into it?
To be honest, it has to be like a roller coaster. So when you go on a roller coaster, it's not just downhill the whole time. You know, there's like all the teasing that goes on before you go downhill. So as long as there's variety, you know, you're all right. It's great to start off with something just to give the audience some visual fireworks straight up front. But you have to also give them time to connect with the characters and understand the stakes of why they should give a shit about who's winning and who's losing or who's going to live or die in some movies. And we are constantly aware of that. And this film is 2 hours, 35 minutes. So it's quite a long film. Top Gun was like 2 hours, 18. Top Gun Maverick was 2 hours, 18. You know, the Grand Prix is 3 hours. It's much longer, you know. But we are always, when you're making the film, you're charting out in your mind the peaks and troughs of the emotional ride for the audience. And you're refining it for days, weeks, months. I mean, each film I work on takes 2 years to edit. And, you know, you're watching the film almost every day for 2 years. And you're showing it to audiences, and you're listening very carefully to how they react, and when they're leaning forward and when they're bored, when they're confused. Confusion and mystery are like two things which you're constantly balancing. It's like, if the film's confusing, you sit back. If the film's mysterious, you kind of lean in because you want to know what's going to happen. But they're both the same kind of feeling. It's just, one is you care about the outcome and the other is you're slightly disengaged because you're confused. And you have to make sure there's enough racing sequences, you know. And certainly when you're working on a film like this, you will usually plot it out, time and kind of emotional ride, where the action sequences are and where the emotional beats are. And, you know, you'll use colors to track how much each character features through the film minute by minute and things like that. So you understand, here's the hero, here's the villain, here's a confrontation, you know, this is act one, the setup, and this is act two and the third act and all that stuff you think about. But a lot of that heavy lifting will also, well, should have been done by the writer of the film. So when you get the script, a lot of that will have been thought through and developed for years. And sometimes the scripts evolve quite a bit as you're shooting the film as well, based on you know, production complications and things like that, and stuff you learn from watching the footage and seeing how the chemistry of the different cast members is working for real on set rather than just in the casting director's imagination. But yeah, you it is a bit of a science, but it's also mostly art and a lot of gut feeling.
What a fantastic place to end. That will have to do us. My thanks to Eddie, to Nick, to Adrian, and to Mark. Check out all the latest F1 news and insights from the upcoming Dutch Grand Prix on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on Twitter, X. And my thanks to producer Ben. Thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow, leave us a review, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport F1 channel, wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify.